With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome, 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 welcome to the Trampoline Hall podcast. I am Misha Globerman, your host. Trampoline Hall, as you know, is a lecture series that takes place in Toronto in a bar. I should say usually in Toronto. Sometimes we go to other cities, but it's usually in Toronto. At Trampoline Hall, people give lectures on all types of topics, with the one restriction being that they cannot be professionally expert in the subject on which they speak. It cannot be their job to know the thing. After each lecture, we take questions from the audience, and by we, I mean I take questions from the audience. This is the Trampoline Hall podcast. The way that works is that we go through the extensive Trampoline Hall archives, we choose individual lectures, each lecture becomes one episode of the podcast, six episodes become a season, and this is the sixth episode of the season, which if you're paying attention means it is the final episode of the season. If you enjoy the podcast and you're in Toronto, you might want to come check out Trampoline Hall live. To find out about that, go to the website tramplinehall.net, get on our email list, and we will send you an email, let you know when the next show is. This episode, of course, may contain mature language. I wanted to warn you about that. And now I will introduce you to the speaker of the episode. The topic is A Life in Flowers, and the speaker is Zach Schwartz.
Hello?
Hi.
Yeah, maybe just a tilt, like a light tilt.
Oh, a light tilt, okay.
Yeah, that's good. Thank you.
Okay. So, Ali was putting pressure on me to give a title to my Trampoline Hall speech, and I do realize that I'm now the second person to roll you under the bus, and I'm sorry about that, because it's because you're such an active and great curator and person that we all arrived where we are today, by some extent. Anyway, she was like, I'm gonna give you some advice, just pick something vague, and then that way you can speak about virtually anything when the night comes, and then pick something sort of utilitarian, because then that won't imply any tone, so whatever tone you have will be the right tone. And then I was like, okay, cool, I just need 24 hours to do this, and she was like, but actually you need to do this right now. And then so I said, A Life in Flowers. And then she was like, I think that is the antithesis of the advice I just gave you. And I said, yeah, but that's pretty, isn't it? And then she said, fine. And so that's how we arrived here. But the thing is, I'm not really sure how to talk about A Life in Flowers. First of all, I'm not really sure about the word in as the preposition. I'm sure some of you noticed that, and you're like, what does this mean? And I don't have that answer for you. And I'm also not sure, I never use capital letters, and I'm really not sure about life with a capital L. That seems like way too big to broach. And so I don't know how to talk about life with a capital L, and I don't know how to talk about how that pertains to flowers, and I don't know how to talk about the poetry therein, but I have been to a few Trampoline Halls, and I know that it's more an exercise in subjectivity than it is in expertise, and I find this to be a great relief, not just in the ways that it services my speech tonight, but also also because I have this shitty, nebulous, overly poetic title to a lecture that sort of sets the stage for a monologue that I don't know the lines to, but then also because I've been thinking about expertise a lot, and I'm not sure that it should exist, and I'm not sure about what motivates it, And I think it maybe stagnates us and it creates sort of a chasm. And shouldn't we be trying to connect and evolve and learn as opposed to categorize and taxonomize and divide? And that's, I was thinking when I was reading this just before I did this speech, I was like, what if that's where my speech ended? And wouldn't that be tight? But then, but it's actually not, because that's actually not the speech at all. And then I had a secondary thought that was like, and I've been, it took me like 11 years to get my undergraduate degree, so like I have no problem with academia, but I feel like, I mean, I have a problem succeeding within academia, but I have no problem with it as an institution. And I felt like maybe, does academia perpetuate this? Like, the more you study, the more narrow your focus becomes and inaccessible and esoteric, and the more explaining you need to do. And then whatever you specialize in, you don't even like know how to tell people. It takes like an entire evening to tell them what your specialty is. So like, we're not really helping anybody at that point or connecting with anybody at that point. But alas, that is absolutely not what my lecture is about. So, and I have zero definitive answers to those questions, which maybe means that I'm on the right track, but also means don't ask me any questions about that in the Q&A, which is the part that I'm most nervous about, because that part I haven't written out. And then so, okay. So if my lecture actually was about a life in flowers, I would begin by talking about my longtime landscaping boss, Norman Sprinkle. And the thing about Norm is that he is a landscaper and he is a gay man. And I know like his sexuality might not have anything to do with this, but I think it does. And I've prepared three reasons why I think it does. Number one is that Norman insisted every day, like every hour that I was with him for seven, I worked there for 7 years, I mentioned, or maybe I didn't, but I worked with him for 7 years, and he insisted on talking about his sexuality every day, and not just in words, there was sublingual stuff happening too, like innuendo and idiosyncrasy, and also he would always, every day he would say this thing like, I drove a truck my whole life and no one called me a trucker, but I sucked one cock and everybody called me a cocksucker. And so like, I think it is intrinsically a part of his identity. And then reason number two is that if you name your child Norman Sprinkle, I think there is something to be said for manifest destiny, and that we have like, we have a responsibility when naming things, which is like a really difficult task, we have a responsibility to name well, and I'm not good at this. I don't want you to think that I think I'm good at this, because I have a cat named Babs Birdie Strawberry Morning Greenheart, and he has like a fucking horrible identity crisis, and like I'm not saying that this is easy, but I don't think that Norman's parents really knocked it out of the park either. And then number three is that, and I think this is somewhat pertinent, is that Norman didn't hire people for his landscaping company based on their experience or landscaping acumen, but he hired them based on A, either their looks, or B, whether they were willing to work topless. And so if there's one thing you can extract from this lecture, is that I am willing to work topless. Like, it's not that big a deal for me. For like $14 an hour cash, like, it's really not that big a deal to me. And I think we all should. So the first 3 years, also not what the lecture is about, but so for the first 3 years of my tenure at Sprinkle Lawn Care and Landscaping, which like now is the perfect time to tell you that we don't do sprinklers, like we're just landscape and lawn care. We're like, we know nothing about sprinklers. We'll outsource. Despite the fact that I would oversee the lawn crew 3 days a week, when it would come time for my 3 days of landscaping with Norm, he didn't think I was ready to handle the hedge trimmers, which was like this great honor, this covetous honor. And so I would just carry a rake around and like rake behind Norm with a paper bag. And then I would try to like drown out his petulant cell phone conversations mostly with his friend Craig. And Craig was Norm's OWL, which is an acronym for older, wiser lesbian, except that I don't know if there's a male equivalent to this, and I tried to find it, but like, you know, is there? Tell me after. Okay, so I tried to find the male equivalent, and but like how Daryl and Camille sort of did like a research-based lecture, but there's no research that went into my lecture, so I just stopped right there. Like, I stopped at the Google search, and I was like, I don't want to pollute this landscape with research. So I don't know. So Craig was his OWL for the purposes of this lecture. And Anyway, I drown out their conversations about Norm's self-diagnosed electrolyte deficiency and Norm's self-diagnosed bee sting sensitivity, and then about how, like, Craig, my favorite story about Craig is that his next-door neighbors filed a noise complaint against him, which he thought, during the day, no less, and which he thought was fueled mostly by homophobia and had nothing to do with his Celine Dion sessions. And then he sought vengeance, like, by night, by moonlight, by poisoning their arborvitaes, which is, like, a super vindictive but also pretty sexy thing to do, I think. I don't know. Because now they just have these, like, bright orange arborvitaes, and now we're entering, like, too deep into landscaping speak, and I've maybe lost my audience. But anyway, I would drown out the cyclicality of their conversations with the cyclicality of sport talk radio, and I would just wait for my big topless moment to, like, put the rake down and take the hedge trimmers and feel their power and go where the hedge tells me to go and, like, listen to it, like, listen to its curves and its whispers and to exhibit sort of the diligence and the precision in manicuring this hedge that I had seen Norm exhibit. And so one day after work, I sat in Craig's sprawling backyard garden oasis and I listened to them, you know, talk about love and lost hope and dreams and stuff. And beneath this sort of canopy of yellow roses of Texas, which were especially hard to grow in the Michigan climate, but only Craig could pull this off, and cloaked in sort of the aromas of, like, new honeysuckle and amidst the beauty of freshly blossomed hyacinths, Norm said, "I think you might be ready." And we were just we were a little bit buzzed on Mike's Hard Lemonade, so I took it, which was Norm's drink of choice, and so I took it with a grain of salt. I guess, like, actually super saccharine alcohol. I took it with a grain of super saccharine alcohol, and I didn't think too much of it. And then Norm and Craig sort of exchanged this knowing glance across the gazebo, and then the sun set sort of softly and sweetly, as I remember it. And then the next morning I woke up, and I got the call, and Norm was like, "I'm low on electrolytes. I need you to take," he's like, "I need you to take the hedge trimmers, and I need you to go to Celia Carr's, and you know those boxwoods are ornery, but you know what to do." And I was like, "Do I know what to do?" He's like, "Take Jordan." And so Jordan is, like, the most inept person on the crew, but he has this, like, this chiseled pectoral, this, like, hairless, and has this, like, super vapid love interest, and, like, virtually nothing to talk about. So I was like, okay, there's some comfort in taking Jordan. So I get to Celia Carr's and I greet her dog Maury with calmness, and I close the gate, I lock the gate behind me, I make sure to lock the gate behind me, and I hold the hedge trimmers and, like, I feel their weight, but not only their weight in the physical realm, but of course in the symbolic realm, as you guys know, and, like, and I take a moment to, like, acknowledge the hedge, and I pull the cord, and then what commenced was this, like, revelation. And the revelation was, this is the easiest fucking thing I've ever done. And, like, anybody, like, truly anybody could do this. And here, and I mean, but for the following reasons, because nature is incredibly resilient, so it's, like, a very low stakes thing that you're doing here. You know what I mean? And then also, the margin for error is incredibly high, which is, like, also very good. And then also the leaves would, like, at just the suggestion of the blades, they would submissively fall to the ground. And so it was, like, not the physically taxing experience I thought it would be. It was none of those things. And then that led to further revelations, like, for example, that the world is full of people who embellish their expertise for the sake of validation of self, and that they treat their knowledge as something esoteric because they're afraid of what they are without it, of course, and that anyone can do this. Anyone with enough determination and patience and access to YouTube can do virtually anything, and I really believe that, and none of my skills or any of our skills are precious, and that we should work towards sharing them, and you don't have to take it from me or from Jordan or from Maury the dog. You just need, like, gas-powered hedge trimmers, and then sort of the world is sort of yours. And so all of this took place in Detroit, which is where I'm from. And when I first moved to Toronto in 2010, and I would tell people I was from Detroit, they'd be like, "Oh, I'm so sorry." And they would meet me with this, like, sort of I don't know, moral supremacy or what. I'm not sure. I'm not sure what narratives were running through your heads at the time. And now when I tell people, they're like, ooh, Detroit, like, I would love to visit there. I've been dying to go there. And I'm like, okay, cool. Yeah, you should definitely go. Except you should know that the post-industrialism, post-capitalist zeitgeist of Detroit is a tiny window closing rapidly, and that all of the altruists and all the dreamers and all the people who believe in this city and what it could be in the face of like all the ruination in America, their voices are being silenced, and the people with corporate interests have swooped in, and it's once again a story of those who have versus those who do not, and of course they've sunk their claws into the tender flesh of Detroit, and pretty soon it will be as exclusive as Brooklyn or Portland or Austin or any of your favorite cities. But anyway, also this is not about Detroit, so but if it were about Detroit, when I was living there, when I moved to the city when I was old enough to leave my parents' house, I was living in this house on an acre in this place called North Corktown, which was sometimes referred to as the urban prairies, because this guy in the 80s, he went on this vigilante mission to burn down any houses that weren't there, that were either being inhabited by squatters or totally vacated. And so it created this sort of beautiful precipice where you would look to the west and you would see the sparseness and the post-apocalyptic sunsets and like the trees. And then you'd look to the east and you would see the sort of towering technicolor lights of Motor City Casino. And it was like this very rare intersection. And I lived in a house that was, I strayed too far from my notes. I don't think I might have lost where I was. Okay, so I lived in this house that was on an acre. And we had, it was the only house on the acre. And I shared it with my housemate, Dana, who was not my wife, which is important to the story later. We had chickens, and we had a vegetable garden, and we had a seesaw that nobody ever used. And I'm like, I feel like adult seesaws, like, that's just a sort of maybe a bad idea from the start. But somebody made it, somebody more hopeful than me. And then we also had this like sunflower patch that must have been there forever because the sunflowers were massive and sort of whimsical and, I don't know, a lot of movement and liquidy. And anyway. And I had, my rent at the time was $430, which I split with my not wife, Dana. So it was $215 for each of us. And my landlord was this guy named Jerry Boudreau. And I loved Jerry for his openness, his childlike sense of wonderment, his inquisitiveness. But what upset me about Jerry was he was also like very dogmatic, and he also could not retain detail or memory, which is like probably not his fault. I mean, the two theories are he is a victim of a closed head injury, which is very serious. I don't know any of this. This is all conjecture. But me and Jerry like never got there. But he's a victim of a closed head injury, which is very serious, or possibly, and this is my theory being not an expert in anything, that his memory had reached its full capacity, and then there was no room for any other, there was no room for input, and it just stagnated there. And I don't know, you guys be the judge, but don't ask me about it in the question and answer portion of this speech. But so one rent day, I saw him standing out by the sunflowers, and I went to talk to him. And he was like holding a sunflower in his hand and staring very pensively into that post-apocalyptic Detroit sunset. And he was like just running the petals between his fingers, and I brought him the check. And he said, thank you. How's your wife, whose name I can't recall? And I said, Jerry, she's not my wife. She is doing very well otherwise. Thank you for asking. And he said, that's no way to speak about somebody you're committed to. I know. And I said, and I was a little bit frustrated at this point because I've probably been living in this house for 2 years now. And like, I am committed to Dana as a housemate, but like and many other things. Like she has a very gifted mind, and we complement each other very nicely. And I would still live with her. Like, I mean, not in a romantic way, but I would still live with her. And she, and so I was a little bit frustrated. And partially I think the frustration comes from resenting your landlord on rent day, which I think is like a really natural thing. And so even for $430. And so I was like, Jerry, we're not in a relationship. I care about her deeply, but she is not my, in fact, I'm dating someone else. And he like stopped. He like let go of the sunflower, and the sunflower sprung up in the air above us, sort of hovering above us and like bobbing in the wind. And then Jerry's bobbing in the wind, and he's still looking towards the horizon. And he said, "I'm an expert in nothing, but there's one thing that I know." And then I'm like, "Okay, sure, I'm ready for this. If this is the one thing that you know as a person who can't remember anything, like maybe this is important or equal parts like totally gobbledygook." And then he looks at me for the first time in this conversation, and then the sunflower was staring at me with like its single eye, which is also very jarring. And he was like, "You never, never embarrass the person you love." And I was like, "Okay, that is wildly out of context, given what I've told you, but it's also the most beautiful advice I've ever heard, and I'm jostled to my core right now." And like, if my lecture was about Jerry, which of course it is not, because there's too much to talk about, I would probably tell you how like my entire life sort of shifted on its axis in that moment, and then what I had learned, and that the advice that he and that omnipotent sunflower gave me, and every time I get the urge to argue with a person I love in public, whenever my emotional self wells up inside of me until my shoulders get hot with the desire to make my point at the expense of the person I love, because that's not what this lecture is about. But if it were, I would also take this moment to tell you about my grandmother, who I called Gibby, and the reason I called her this was because when I was a baby and I was learning to speak, I had a grandma, a grandpa, a gran, and a papa, and I called them Gibby, 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 and Papa. My dad's mom loved that name so much that she kept it, and I was the oldest grandchild, so everybody called her Gibby. And which brings on a quick digression, which is maybe this whole lecture is a digression, but the quick digression is that why is it that when we really love somebody, like the most important people in our life, like the centrifugal force, like our mothers and grandmothers, like why do we call them mom and grandma? Like we basically take what is individual and unique about them and then we sort of put them in this generic category. And so I don't like that. And that's all. But then and then my other question that I think has to do with that, and maybe this is my Q&A period for you guys, is like, why are we celebrated on our birthday? Because like we did nothing to be brought into this world except for 9 months. We just like took and took and took and took and took. And then we come out and then comes like the relief and then the fawning. And then of course the megalomania and the solipsism and the egocentrism. And then, do you know what I mean? Like why on our birthdays, we should give our moms a fucking present on our birthdays. Like they did all the work. And then on Mother's Day, are you a mom or? Oh, okay. It's just a relatable sentiment. Yeah, and thank you. I'm glad. I was worried that it wasn't, that no one's gonna get it. And then on our birthdays, we give our mom the present. And then on what we know right now as Mother's Day, all the kids, everybody who's a kid gets a present. And then that way it's not like our special day, you know, because we did nothing to deserve it. And then Father's Day stays the same because that's like sort of on the periphery. And then on Father's Day, we just get like, we go to the freezer and we get like a unwrapped pack of Marlboro cigarettes and or a carton and we give it to our dad. Or we get like, we go to the trunk and then we get like a spatula that like presses the logo of his alma mater sports team into like a burger. And so that's just Father's Day. And so Father's Day stays the same. But just real quick, this is sort of the end, is that I'm gonna take this opportunity to eulogize my grandmother, which I didn't realize was happening until I had read this speech like 15 minutes before I gave it, because I never had the opportunity to do that. And why I think it ties into Trampoline Hall is that when we were coming in, Kate said, "Hey, welcome lecturers. This is your one chance to speak at Trampoline Hall. This is it, it's permanent. Like, you know, there's finality here." And I'm paraphrasing, but, and I didn't know that. And then I thought, well, that makes this like way more daunting. And then I thought, well, you know, my grandma died like 10 years ago and I thought that was my one chance to eulogize her, but it turns out it's not. So I'm gonna like abuse this tiny little sliver of power that I have just because I have a working microphone in front of me. I'm gonna eulogize her really quickly and just say that my Gibby was deliberate and judicious and she had a slowness and a grace and all of these qualities manifested in her garden, balance, feng shui, diversity of color, diversity of plant, everything neatly and slowly trimmed, everything maintained and everything acknowledged. And all of this, in my mind, juxtaposed poetically against the suburban concrete home that she lived in with a highly chlorinated pool and stucco walls that were stained yellow from decades of chain smoking and sharp-edged tables and dust and unsavory shag carpets and brooding framed portraits of like old white men in like boiler hats. And then what I would call domicile, I'm not sure. I should have looked that up. I can't do research. But what I would call domicile decay. And so her spirit was obviously in the garden and not in the home. And when she died, the garden fell into a state of disrepair, neglect, wildness, and it became more a reflection of my grandfather's broken spirit than my Gibby's memory. And so instead of her out there chain-smoking ciggies, as she called them, it was now my grandpa drinking his Cutty Sark neat with a twist, blind as hell at this point, 3 years after my Gibby had passed away, and I was swimming in the now even more chlorinated pool that was the nasty byproduct of my grandfather's blindness and stubbornness, and that which he now embodied. And I was getting these sort of hot hits of chlorine in my eyes that were making me feel more alive. And I watched as my grandpa reached out and discovered a single rose that had somehow emerged from the Garden of Ruin. And I remember it was a variegated rose with hues of yellow and orange, which I wish were my Gibby's favorite colors, but actually her favorite color was cobalt, a deep blue, which is more fitting. And it had risen from the chaos of neglect. And he stared at it through his milky blue cataracts, and I stared at him through my eyes burning from chlorine. And he began to weep. And if I was going to talk about a life in flowers, I would definitely share with you what I felt in that moment, waiting in the pool, the hum of a distant lawnmower, and the echoes of my grandpa's sobs, the only sounds in the air. That's all.
Zach Schwartz, Elijah Flowers.
You're listening to the Trampoline Hall Podcast. I'm Misha Goldman. Up next, the Q&A.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedy ad free. That's amazon.com/comedy ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Are there any questions?
No questions. I'm just kidding. You can ask me anything.
Yes, all the way in the back. You, ma'am.
So what do you think is up with feeling an argument in your shoulders?
Why do you feel an argument in your shoulders? What's up with that? Could you feel that too? Sometimes.
That's a great question. I don't know. I know very little about anatomy. I'm often at odds between my, like, you know, my physical self and my cerebral self. But I think it just has to register somewhere. I mean, I know that probably other people feel it in their fists. Like, there's pretty well-documented evidence of this. And, like, for me, it just surges. Like, it just surges, and I feel it. My shoulders get tense, and my posture gets, like, really unsavory. And I don't know. I don't know, that's just me, but maybe it's you too. I don't know.
Does that answer your question? Sure it does. Yeah. Anything else? Any other questions you would like? Yeah, so over here, yes.
Do you have a favorite memory of your grandmother?
Do you have a favorite memory of your grandmother?
Oh yeah. Oh, Bibi. Yeah. One of my favorite memories of her, I guess I'm gonna start with the grim one and then I'll go to a more pleasant one, which was she, when she was dying and everybody knew she was dying, I would go visit her and she had this like extensive and magical library of like first edition books because she came from a great wealth that she rejected because her dad was a bad dad and her mom wasn't in the scene. And so she took his money and then she stopped taking his money, but what she did with his money was build this incredible library. And so I would go to her house and she, as I was leaving, I'd like go give her a smooch on the forehead and she'd say, you need to go get some books. And I'd be like, Gibby, I'm not taking your books. And then she'd be like, well, I can't take them with me. And then so I'd have to go pick out like 4 or 5 books to appease her. So now I have a pretty good library, but I don't treat it the way she does. And then, but also when I was a kid, we would like comb the beach in this tiny and pretty unremarkable part of Michigan. And I would pick out rocks that I loved. And then me and my Gibby would polish them. And that is a sacred memory.
Does that answer your question? Yeah, it does. Yeah.
Are you crying? No, just good. Thank good. Thank good. Do you miss her? No, I'm just kidding. That was a great question. Thank you.
Yeah, back there. Yes.
What are you going to give your mom for your birthday?
What do you give your mom? What are you going to give your mom for your birthday?
That's a really good question. I think, fuck. Yeah, maybe I'll just go to Florida where she lives, which is like a huge sacrifice. That would be nice. I'll give her the gift of my presence, which is like so counterintuitive to what I was saying about solipsism and like egomania, where I'm just like, Mom, I bequeath to you like me for 3 days. Like, or maybe, I don't know. I'll make her something nice. I always make her something.
What do you think? Does that seem okay to you? Does that seem like a good gift? Just like, here I am again? Or are you, like, between that and the make her something, do you have a... It depends what you would make her.
I've made her very nice things. I feel like I'm out of things to make. Like, she and I need to have more memories. Do you know what I mean? Like, we need to make more memories together, and then I'll make more shit.
Take her to where? Take her to
Disney
World.
Oh, you want it to cycle back. You want me to pay it forward. Like, you want the circle to close in on itself. I get it. Okay, cool. Yeah, because she took me there, and obviously you know that. Because I asked her.
Why do you know that?
Well, just because... No, I'm just kidding.
Do you know that because you know each other? You know that just because that you figure that's a universal... Okay,
yeah, we're just riffing.
All right. Okay, all right, okay. All right, cool. All right, yes, yes. Do you think Norma Sprinkle thinks about you as much as you think about him?
I know that he does, yeah. I know that he does because I think what I brought to Norm versus what some of the other crew members brought to Norm was like, I don't have the pecs. You know what I mean? Like, I don't have the physique. But what I would bring that they didn't know how to bring was like a willingness to listen to Norm, which became grating and excruciating over time. But like, it's... It is, for better or for worse, like the way in which maybe I think we can all connect with people is to like listen to them and then allow them to say things and then listen to what they have to say when they know that someone's listening. And so I gave that to Norm. We're not really talking anymore, but we didn't have an explicit falling out. But
wait, you did not have an explicit falling out?
No,
just
we didn't.
Like gradual,
just you know,
drifting
all
apart,
things must pass.
Like, yeah, okay, sure. Yeah, it can't be forever.
Yeah, but beauty is ephemeral.
But he still thinks of you often.
I know he does. He must.
You assume. On the whole, would you rather be someone who's good at listening or someone with really good pecs?
Wait, really good pets?
Pecs.
Oh.
Wasn't that the distinction you drew?
Yeah, pets. Yeah, yeah.
You were like, I was like...
I thought you said pets. I thought you said pets.
Yeah, that would be weird.
And I was like, what do you know about Babs?
That's my follow-up question.
No, what do you know about Babs Birdie Strawberry Morning Greenheart that I didn't mention in this lecture? No, I think I will take the pecs. Yeah.
All right, okay, just checking. All right, cool. Anything else? Yes, you, ma'am, the non-mother in the front row.
What did you study in university?
What did you study in university? That's just small talk now. Oh, because it took 11 years, right? What would take so long?
Well, I was using...
That was not my question.
No, that was not your question. That's my question. What would take so long? Thank you for sharing the responsibility appropriately there.
So this is like a two-person, two-part question.
Yeah.
I studied English literature, and I studied linguistics, and then I finally graduated from radio, television, and the arts at Ryerson. Yeah.
There you go.
And it took so long because I was using university as a vehicle to travel, and I had no value for like money or a degree or anything. And maybe I still don't. Right. But I went to 5 different undergraduate universities.
Whoa. Okay. All right.
Yeah. So, and I have very little.
Did you have more? You had more. What do you want else? What else do you want to know?
Where did you study?
What? Where? Where did you study? What?
I started at University of Vermont, which is where people go to just basically burn out entirely, and everybody drops out after the first year, and so I did. And then I went to Michigan State University, and then I went to, I was living in the West Coast, and I wanted to stay, so I went to UBC, and that thus began my Canada journey. And then I went to Wayne State in Detroit, and then I finished in Ryerson, I think. I don't know. Thank you. Thank you.
Does that answer your question? It does, indeed. All right, great. Yes, back there. Yes, back there. Oh, yeah, you, the person looking behind you to see if, yeah.
Okay. So you had a really lovely moment with Jerry. Did Dana have a lovely moment with Jerry that she was like, oh, my God, and then she told you, or did that ever?
So you want to know how Dana and Jerry interacted?
You had this really incredible memory of like, oh, you've changed my life, but I still don't like you, but you've changed my life.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if Dana ever got to have
it. Did Jerry change Dana's life? Did Dana get to get from Jerry what you got from Jerry? What did Dana get from Jerry?
That's
fair. What we're all asking ourselves.
I mean, it's fair. I think probably not. And this is why I think that Jerry just sort of in the little, what I believe to be born-again Christian, micro-universe, deeply religious sect that he came from, I think I was a more fit liaison for our rent checks. And so Dana didn't get to know him in the same way. Yeah. Which is, you know, I wish she did. Although I can already tell her how it would play out. Like, I got from that everything that either Dana or I needed.
So you figure just, like, Jerry just has certain things to give, and no matter who you are, so if I were to interact with Jerry, I would take from Jerry what you took from Jerry.
And now
basically.
You don't need to.
That's
yeah.
basically
yeah.
it.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
I can, like,
that,
those are just, None he's got yeah. those things to give.
And
so
I imagine that rent went up, too, so there's
right.
no point.
Right, and we all got those things, really, from mm-hmm. Jerry today. Okay. Yes, you, ma'am.
I'm curious about what kinds of stuff you made your mother over.
More about what have you made your mother over the years.
Finally, yeah. Because that was my backup lecture. it was just a list of stuff that I made my mom. And then at the end, everybody's like, oh, he loves his mom. So thank you for asking. I make stained glass as sort of a side project. I don't make the glass, but I make art out of stained glass. And so I've made her many different iterations of glass. I made a mosaic of our late dog, Gus, a very well-named pet. I will say, like, I didn't, because I obviously didn't name it. I made her a mosaic of, like, or not a mosaic, but a stained glass, sort of, they're called sun catchers, because they pick up the light when you hang them in the window. It's actually a pretty literal name, now that I say it out loud, and Misha laughs. I'm like, well, here's why it's called sun catchers. It's, like, so didactic, and so, anyway. I made her a sun catcher of a make-believe place called Rossman Bay, which is my mom's maiden name, which is my middle name, which I wish was my last name, because I like my mom's side of the family more than my dad's. And other stuff like that.
Just in case, for those of you in the audience wondering, what is the person who's asking the question look like while you're giving the answer? That she was nodding approvingly, like through the whole thing.
Yeah.
It's like the most approving nodding that I've ever seen come from the audience during a trampoline hop.
Affirmations.
They're very thoughtful and gentle. Yeah, it wasn't just like, oh, he made her like an ashtray. It was like, these are like.
If it makes everybody feel better, my mom's birthday is around the same time as Mother's Day. And so it's like sort of a. Well, in kids'
doubling
day.
Up, doubling up.
Yeah.
You'd be
yeah,
like, you
yeah.
you don't get her two things. You get her one thing. You're like, here, this is for both.
Heavens no. Yeah.
All right. Okay.
Yeah, one thing for both.
Sure. That's reasonable. And yes, back there. Yes, you have your hand up. Yeah.
What are some things you can do to avoid embarrassing your partner?
What are some things you can do to avoid embarrassing your partner? Do you ask because you embarrass your partner or because your partner embarrasses you? Or?
Yeah, that's a great question.
Yeah.
And again, this is conjecture and it's deeply subjective. And I'm not sure this will apply to you. But. When I feel very passionate about something, and I think that passion is often rooted in a defensiveness that's pretty ugly. And so what I do to embarrass my partner is I insist upon making my point, often at their expense. And what I think is a good exercise to not embarrassing your partner, which I've never fully been able to do, as will... as I'm sure all of my ex-lovers in the crowd can speak to tonight, is that I allow my emotional self to take over. Like, it's a rising tide in me, and I can't control it. And I think, and I'm working on this too, and I'll work on it with you, I think you have to have, like, a mantra that reminds you of your intellectual self, and you need to be, like, reciting it over and over and over and over so that it becomes rote, so that you know that the ways in which you... interact are not fueled totally by emotion, but rather some overlap between emotion and intellect.
So you think intellect specifically, so you think the answer lies in the intellect, like the...
No, I don't mean intellect. I mean just using your mind and not just your...
whatever the
like your instinct,
is.
Like to
yeah,
be,
that's
to
the
be
one.
Conscious,
the instinct,
to be conscious
yeah.
of
the subconscious, the subconscious. Okay, yeah, right. Just have a dialogue between your subconscious and your
okay. So the answer, is that does that?
But that's not my. I mean, I don't know. That's my. I don't. I'm not saying that that's true. I'm saying like, that's a suggestion. That's not empirical.
Does that get, in fact, because you haven't had
I'm not qualified to answer that question.
Because you haven't had success with it is the reason. Is that right? Like,
yeah.
Do you have you had success with it or no, it's not?
I have.
So it makes it seem sensible.
Thank you. No, in varying degrees. I've had varying degrees of success.
Okay,
that would
all
sort of amount to
has anyone, all right, does that, first of all, does that feel like satisfying? Yeah. Yeah, does that work? Do you feel like, are you, do you think you could try that out or ask someone else to try it out, depending on? Sorry? Right, it's harder than like just drink.
Oh,
less
don't do
advice.
That. Definitely don't do that. I have. Well, I haven't tried that. That might work too.
Yeah, we don't want to try anything drastic, though. Okay. All right. So there you go. So that. Any other questions? Anything else you would like to know? Yes, back there. Yeah.
You mentioned that we hold on to our skills and our knowledge because we're terrified of who we are without them. Who do you think we are without them, or who can we be without them? What's the idea?
So if we're terrified of who we are without our skills and knowledge, who is it that we are without them? Like, is there an ideal there?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good question. And again, like, I don't purport to have the answer. But what I would say is, like, I know what Norman is without them. He's somebody with, like, you know, crippling debt who doesn't manage his money or time well, and all of these, like, burnt out flames. And, like, you know, he, like, lingers on details that are not important to stories or not important to film and stuff like that. So I think when he has that, the gifted when he has the gifted ability to trim hedges, like, that gives him maybe a stronger sense of meaning. But I think, you know, maybe if we blow up that sense of meaning a little bit, I don't know, there could be a capital T truth there, but I actually don't know. I don't know if it is. Good question. I have no idea.
And do you think it matters that the expertise is like in his case, the expertise is like made up, like it's not even real. But do you think it matters? Like, is it any, like, I guess comparing him to university professors, where at least the expertise, at least in theory, is like real. Like, they have, I don't know, like, it's not hard to operate the hedge trimmer, but it is hard to, like, write a book about Nietzsche. I don't know, whatever, you know, like,
yeah.
Like, does it matter whether it's actually hard or not, or is it the same thing?
I don't know. I don't know. It depends what sort of vantage point you're taking it from. Like, yeah, I think there's probably more, whatever it means to have, like, societal accolades or something, it's probably more meaningful to be able to write a book on Nietzsche.
I don't know why I made that. I don't know why that was, like, my example.
Because you wanted to see
thing.
If I could say it. And, and nobody can, because nobody even fucking knows anymore. But
that's my hedge trimmer, saying
yeah,
Nietzsche.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm like, oh, I don't know if he's ready to say Nietzsche.
Better. Oh, that was
I don't
better.
Know if he's ready to say
Because mine ended too quickly. I wrapped mine up too quickly. But yours, like, sort of, yeah, yours is sort of splayed out. Nietzsche.
That's what it's all about. That's
yeah.
what it's all about.
Yeah. I don't know if it matters. I don't know. I didn't mean to launch too deeply into the existential. That's a good question.
Yeah. All right. Maybe I'll wrap it up there. Ladies and gentlemen, Zach Schwartz, ladies and gentlemen.
Trampling Hall was created in Toronto in the 21st century by Sheila Hetty and is hosted by me. This episode's lecture was originally chosen by Ali Waterman. The podcast is produced by Josh Block. Our theme music was composed by Matt Smith. Our coordinating producer is Kate Barrs. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also find us on Twitter and Facebook. If you enjoyed the podcast, you might also want to leave a rating and review on iTunes. It really helps us out a lot. I'm Misha Globerman. Thanks for listening.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.